Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lisa C., whose latest novel is Dreams of Joy. It's a sequel to Shanghai Girls. Lisa C. is the author of 7 books. And Snowflower and the Secret Fan is a film, and we will be talking about that. But first, Dreams of Joy. At what point during the writing of Shanghai Girls did you realize that you wanted to write a follow-up book?
At no point during the writing of Shanghai Girls, actually. I mean, I actually have to go back a little, because when I first started writing Shanghai Girls, I originally envisioned it going from 1937 to 2007. It had a very different setup, and it started completely differently. And I had gotten about 100 pages in when I realized there's, like, no, you know, I was still in Shanghai. I was still in 1937. I was never going to get to 2007. And so I looked at what I had, and I knew what I really wanted to write about. And one of the things was the confession program, which had happened in 1957. And I really felt like if I didn't go out and talk to people who had been, you know, had participated or been victimized by the confession program now, that I might never get a chance, because those people aren't getting any younger. So, you know, to me, goes 1937, 1957, the end was a new beginning, and I was really, really happy with the ending. And I sat down, I started thinking about what the next book would be. I wrote up 3 ideas. I sent them to my editor in New York. I went back to New York to talk to him about them. And while we were talking, and you know, when you have like ideas, it's like, well, this one, you know, this one I'm going to have to go to China, and it's going to be a really remote place, and I've just been in a really remote place, and it's really hard. You know, so you're sort of looking at the pros and cons of writing each book. And as we were doing that, the publisher of Random House came in, and she said, you know, we really want you to write those 3 ideas one of these days, but first you've got to write the sequel. And I have to say, I really resisted it at first, because I don't know, the end was a new beginning, and I was really happy. The book was not out yet, but it was done. I mean, it had gone to copy editing. It was in production. It may seem like it's a setup, but to me, the end was a new beginning. I was happy with that.
Well, the book ends, okay, a quick synopsis of Shanghai Girls. 2 sisters are in China. They escape China. They come to America. World War II has happened. They're in America. The confession is when people are willing to say who they are, that they've come illegally, and there'll be an amnesty. Meanwhile, there's a daughter of one of them who's raised by the other. At the very end of Shanghai Girls, the daughter disappears, presumably going back to China, and one of the 2 mothers says, I'm going after her,
right.
The end, which
right.
Seems to open up a sequel.
I know, but I didn't see it that way. Yet I came home, and I'm nothing if not an obedient Chinese daughter, so I started doing research, and, you know, I liked what could come next. And it is true, originally I had plotted to 2007, so I had an idea of what could happen and what might happen, although certainly what I originally plotted is not in this book at all.
What did you originally plot?
I had originally thought that Shanghai Girls would start with an old woman looking back on her life, that she was kind of like the Martha Stewart of China, if you will, that she had made a kind of empire out of taking old things like the beautiful girl posters, the Art Deco furniture and furnishings of the 1930s, the things that Pearl and May had grown up with, and sort of brought that up to the present and made it something that people wanted to buy all over the world, that she was a secretive woman being interviewed and was looking for her granddaughter, her lost granddaughter, who would have been the daughter of the Joy in this book. None of that ever ended up being part of either of these books. So, you know, it shows how things can evolve and change. But, you know, as I did the research for Dreams of Joy, you know, I thought, well, I'd like to do this, but I didn't want to go 20 years. I wasn't sure what voice it would be in. And so just before Shanghai Girls came out, I was back in New York, and the very first event was going to be that night. And I had lunch with my editor, and I had this list of questions of, you know, if I do it this way, do it this way. And by the end of lunch, I felt really good about writing the sequel. Then a couple of hours later, you know, had the first event, and the first question was from someone who had had an advanced reader's edition. And the very first question was, are you going to write a sequel? And that turned out to be either the first or second question from every reader, every email, every book club, every event, every interviewer, from the moment that book came out right to today. As far as the ending for Shanghai Girls, either I'm learning to become a better writer, or I really don't know what I'm doing, and it could be maybe that latter one.
Certainly, leaving Pearl to go off running after Joy, we knew that Joy was probably going to be going to China.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that this book would be about China once you sat down to write it, which makes it, in many ways, a very, very painful book to read, because it deals with some very difficult times in a country that we know in America very little about, particularly during those years.
Right. So one of the reasons why I didn't want this book to go for another 20 years was that meant that it would have gone through the Cultural Revolution. And I think there's been so much written about the Cultural Revolution. I didn't really want to write about the Cultural Revolution. And the year after Joy Goes Back, 1958, was the launch of the Great Leap Forward. And you're right. I think not very many people know about the Great Leap Forward, or what they know is just this little tiny bit. And I just think what happened during that period is so extraordinary. But that also, if you have read about the Cultural Revolution or know anything about the Cultural Revolution, that never would have happened without what happened during the Great Leap Forward, because, you know, it was after the Great Leap Forward, Mao kind of stepped down, he stepped back, and the launch of the Cultural Revolution was a way to divert attention from the failures of the Great Leap Forward.
And the Great Leap Forward was in its own way a genocide.
Mm-hmm. You know, it certainly was not intentional, but that was the result.
You did make the decision to have two point-of-view characters, which are Pearl heading back after Joy, and then, of course, Joy, and making the decision to have Joy be someone who would eventually become disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that did happen in those days. You know, when I started this book, my mom said to me, "This is going to be the shortest book ever. Pearl and Joy go to China, they step off the plane, and they're shot. You know, that's the end of the book." I said, well, okay, that's right. But I think that her feeling about that was because we tend to think of China in those days as being completely closed. You know, Nixon opened China. Before that, it was closed. But it wasn't as closed, and certainly in these days, not as closed as we've all been led to believe. Tremendous numbers of people went back to China, ethnic Chinese from around the world, who went back, including those who are American citizens. 90,000 Chinese went back to Fujian province alone, just one province. This was tremendous numbers of people. And many of them, you know, went back with this idea that here is a new country, 8 years old. We're going to create something that has not been created before. And there was this sense of enthusiasm and idealism that for many people was dashed very quickly, just very, very quickly.
The two prongs of the story, we're going to talk a little about each of them, because most of it is Pearl in the city of Shanghai and Joy in the country. I wish that there had been a map here, because I felt a little bit lost. Now, we have down in the south Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Up the coast, we have Shanghai. Inward from that, kind of heading south, was the original village that Pearl is from, right?
The village that Pearl is from the south near Guangzhou, Canton. So that's near Hong Kong. So actually, I sort of modeled the village, their home village, on my own family's home village, which is about 100 miles from Hong Kong.
Joy's village,
where she goes to work first in a collective, then in a commune. It's about 250 kilometers from Shanghai.
To the north.
Yeah, northwest. And that's actually sort of modeled on a village that I went to. It's called Huangshan in Anhui province. Whatever 250 kilometers is in miles is what? A little less than 200 miles from Shanghai, one of the most modern cities now in the world. And going to this village, it's like stepping back in time, you know, 100, 200 years.
the village itself and the research you did, I mean, when she goes there, they eat certain things, they have a daily life, there's loudspeakers going on, there's some fear, but most of the fear seems to be to stay in line with the other people in the village. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the cadres who more or less run the show. But it's not a terrible life, or is it?
I don't think it's a terrible life. I mean, especially in those early days, I think people really benefited especially in the countryside in the first few years of communism under this new rule where they had their own land. You know, land reform had happened. So they had their own land for the first time ever in 5,000 years of history. They had a sense, I think, of equality. Women, life for women had been completely transformed. You know, women who had spent their entire lives indoors now came out and became part of the world and society and culture in a way that they never had before. That's not to say that life in a Chinese village is easy. It's never been easy. It's still not easy. But I think in that moment, people looked at it as this is the best we've ever had.
And then what exactly happened? Did Mao suddenly go off the deep end?
I've been thinking about that quite a bit. Were his intentions evil? No. He had gone to Moscow. It was right after the launch of Sputnik. He was very inspired by Sputnik and by what was happening in the USSR. And he came back with this idea that China could surpass Great Britain in steel production and agricultural production in 15 years. Then he changed it to 7 years, then 2 years, and then he sort of said, oh, let's forget Great Britain. Let's just surpass the United States in that amount of time. And they thought that they would be able to do it, you know, very quickly. I don't think it's a bad thing for a country to have a goal, all right? You know, I don't. I think that's a good thing, for a country to have a goal and something that you're working towards. The bad part that happened was that it was the people down below those cadres, the people who are running the communes, who wanted to meet these huge expectations of, instead of saying, I'm just going to make up a number, 1,000 pounds of grain to the city, we're going to deliver 10,000 tons of grain to the city. There was no way for the people to be able to do that. You know, people were very diverted away from agriculture into creating steel. And the way they did it was they took all of their cooking utensils, farm implements, hairpins, the door hinges, any piece of metal that they could find, and they melted them in these outdoor furnaces. That turned out to be totally, totally useless and was just a big waste of material but also time. That meant that people weren't working in the fields in the way that they should have. Plus, there had been all of these kind of cockamamie schemes of how to increase agricultural production. So instead of planting one seed, we're going to put 10 seeds in one spot, or we're going to add all these nutrients like ground glass. Well, ground glass doesn't do anything to grow wheat. You know, it just doesn't.
And these were national.
These were national ideas. And these scientists who came up with these ideas of this is how we're going to improve production. I don't think, I mean, this is just my opinion, that Mao set out with this idea of I'm going to launch this program so that 45 million people will starve to death. But there was this side effect of the people around him who wanted to create what he wanted. They wanted to give him what he was asking for, and there was no real way to do it. So you had to kind of make up these schemes and inflate numbers.
And it all came down to these villages, like the village where Joy mm-hmm. is. In terms of your research, you were able to take the material you had about what was happening in China and then apply it specifically to that village and see how people would react.
Mm-hmm. That is how I did it, although I do know there's a scholar who spent a lot of time in Huangshan, and she had also interviewed a lot of people about that time period. You know, many of the things that I describe that happened are things that she told me about that had actually happened in that particular village.
Trading babies.
That is something that I had read about. There are about three nonfiction, very good nonfiction books about what happened during the Great Leap Forward. There are three of them. They took very different perspectives. One just wrote about one particular village. One has taken a sort of more global approach to how he did his research. But Swap Child, Make Food is something that comes up in all of their work. So, yes, it was something that definitely did occur.
And did you do any research on the nature of starvation, too?
Yes, I did. Reading people's memoirs of that time, and that when you would see someone on the street in a city, let's say, instead of saying hello, you would press your thumb on the other person's forehead to see how much edema they had and how quickly did your skin bounce back to where it was supposed to be.
The sequences toward the end of the book in which people are starving to death, there are skeletons walking along, falling by the side of the road. That's in these books.
Yes, and that was one of the things that really struck me. And this is not just about China, but in my research about starvation, is the desire of a human being to keep going. And so you see this now in Africa and other, you know, other places in the world where they have starvation, where people will crawl along the ground just literally pulling themselves hand over hand. They don't know where they're going, but they're just going. And I guess, you know, that they're going in search of food, but this desire as a human being to keep going forward, and hopefully you're escaping what is behind you and you will find something to eat along the way. That, to me, just really struck me, because you see it in place after place and time after time. Humans have this desire to live and survive, and they will just keep going until there is nothing left.
And burying people alive to just cut back on the number of people who are going to eat?
One of the things that happened in the rural areas was that the people in charge, power corrupts, and they were, I think, pretty terrified themselves. And so there was a lot of abuse by the people in charge of the people who they were supposed to be taking care of. I barely actually touched on the things that were going on at that time. You know, this we're really focusing on just a couple chapters at the end of the story. There should be no surprise about man's inhumanity to man. And so to me, what I was interested in sort of writing about that period was to think about this young woman born in America, you know, an American citizen, someone who was raised here, who's gone back with all of this enthusiasm, who builds a life out in a village, and then what happens to her, and what a mother will do for her child, but also what a child will do for her mother.
Did you know the kind of person her husband would be, or did that just come out in the writing?
I had a feeling about that guy. I mean, I liked him at the beginning, but I just had a feeling about him. And, you know, there are other characters. Dunn is, you know, someone who is a boarder in Pearl's family home in Shanghai. I had a feeling about the kind of person that he was, too. But I didn't know that he would turn out to be the kind of, you know, pretty wonderful and heroic man that he is.
Let's move on, Lisa C., to life in Shanghai, because Pearl follows her daughter and winds up living in Shanghai for some time. The research on that, I was fairly stunned that the rich people got to stay in their mansions with their servants years after the revolution.
Mm-hmm. You know, and there are a lot of memoirs about that. I don't know if you've ever read Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Cheng, which is just fabulous, fabulous memoir, really mostly about the Cultural Revolution. But this was a woman who had worked, I believe, for Texaco even after the revolution. And you see this in many accounts, that people were encouraged to keep all of their servants because the government didn't want to have a huge unemployment rate. And so they really wanted people to keep their servants, keep the cooks, keep the gardeners, keep the valets, keep the personal maids, all of that just stayed in place. And it wasn't until quite a bit later, actually, the Cultural Revolution, where that now, you know, quite a bit later was turned around. But, you know, I don't want to suggest that people didn't go hungry in cities. They did. And they stripped the trees of leaves, and they stripped the bark, and they ate all kinds of things. It was not nearly as bad as it was in the countryside. But people did go hungry, and yet there was a certain class of people, a certain level of people who were still ordering food in from Harrods, you know, and going to fancy banquets. Does that really come as a surprise? No, not really. You know, I think we all know that in any country, there's the people who have and the people who don't.
The character of Ziji, who was the patron of the Shanghai girls before they left, he's still an artist and he's quite successful. That means that you also did research into the nature of art in China in 1957, describing different types of art.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ziji, of course, started out as a painter doing commercial art, making these beautiful girl posters that were so prevalent in the 1930s. And over time, that kind of poster art did evolve into propaganda art, and it's, you know, takes the same shape in many cases, even some of the same images and style, except that instead of a beautiful girl in a pretty boudoir, she's a kind of healthy, strong-looking girl, a little heavier, driving a tractor or working in the fields. Just as the beautiful girl posters were trying to sell this idea of a new modern Chinese woman, these new posters were also trying to sell the idea of a new modern Chinese woman, a woman who was not inside, who was not cared for, who was strong and robust and you know, could do anything, go up on high tension wires or work on dams or whatever. So there's that kind of art, and there were sort of four accepted forms of art at that time. And they all had some kind of a deeper political meaning. So some of it was socialist realism, just very much in the style of what was going on in Russia. Some of it was traditional brush and ink painting. So the style of the painting remained the same, but the content was different. Ziji, he's interesting because he's, you know, he is an artist.
Did that character shift and change? Did you always plan on bringing him in early on? I was almost expecting this to be a search, but it's not.
I felt it was really important because I wanted to get going with the story and what was going to happen to them. I had a lot of discussions with my editor about that. You know, is it too easy for her to find him? I thought, well, he's famous. Of course she's going to find him. It's going to be easy. To me, that was very logical. That because one thing about Joy is that at least in the beginning, you know, she's young, she's idealistic, and she's kind of dumb. I mean, I think I can say that as the person who wrote her. And so she has a kind of dumb luck, I think, at the beginning, how easy it is for her to go back in and how easy it is for her to find her father. That to me, really works for her at the beginning. And, of course, Pearl going in, it's much more difficult, and she has a very hard time finding her daughter. But to get Joy out there and going, I just thought it was important for her to meet Ziji right away. Now, Ziji, bringing up my mom again, but I have five people who read my manuscripts at the same time. One is my mother, one is my sister. And my mom called Clara, and she said, you know, that ZG, he's such a cipher. You know, it's really hard to understand him. He's not a typical dad. I wonder where Lisa would have gotten, you know, like, thought of a dad like that. And my sister said, do you remember who you married? You know, so While I think of Dreams of Joy as really being about mother love, you know, that sort of the deepest theme is about mother love. In fact, it's very much about the love between a father and a daughter, or a daughter and her father, and certainly how Joy feels about Sam, the man she thought was her father, and how she comes to understand ZG as her father. But my dad, the book is dedicated to him. He's not a golf playing or TV watching or he's not like that. I mean, he never called me pumpkin or princess or any of that stuff. He was never the coach for the soccer team. I don't think I'm the only person who has a father that doesn't fit that kind of mold of what we think of as being a father or what we've been told on TV is a father. And I think a lot of people are going to relate to him on that level as being kind of distant, a little preoccupied, not necessarily what you think of as an idealized father, I guess.
In Shanghai, Pearl gets a job picking up paper, and it sounds like you found a lot of those strange stories about life in China in that era.
I did kind of get caught up in the idea of paper. It is true. And I guess that's one of the fun things about writing a book is that you can have something in your mind about paper and sort of play it out and see all the things you could do with paper. So while I wouldn't say it's central to the plot or anything, it's certainly there. And so Pearl is basically a trash collector, but she sort of looks at it from the tradition of being a collector that really comes out of the reverence for lettered paper societies. In the past, you know, you were not allowed to walk on lettered paper, that they had these societies that would go and pick up and salvage any paper that had written characters on them, preserve them, burn them ritually, and then once a year they would be taken to the river or to the ocean and ritually spread out so that those words could then come back, be reborn again. And I really loved that idea. Of course, I love words, right? I mean, this is what I do. I suppose I have a reverence for lettered paper as a writer. But I also thought about all the different things. And of course, paper is a Chinese invention. So thought about all the different ways that paper is used. And so they're the letters from to and from May. And how that their Pearl and May's whole relationship gets resolved. It's all through letters. The shoes that are the soles of the shoes that are made with paper, how paper can be used to stop up cracks in around a window to keep the cold out and eaten if you are desperate enough.
Did you go to Shanghai again?
I did for this book. I went to Shanghai and out to Huangshan. I was on the same trip.
What does the Shanghai today look like in terms of the way it looked when Pearl was there in 58 and when the beautiful girls were there in the late 30s?
The area along the Bund, which is right along the river, they have done a beautiful job of preserving those buildings today. During the period in Dreams of Joy, all of that had really decayed. I mean, it was all there. They didn't tear it down, but no one was caring for it. When Mao took power, people looked at Shanghai as a kind of a decadent city, too Western, and a sort of a city filled with vice, like a woman who should be punished, I think is the way to look at it. And so for many, many, many years, from 1949 until about 1995, it was really in decay. And then now there's been this incredible resurgence, and it's now today, maybe not the Paris of Asia as it once was. It certainly is not the New York of Asia. New York may be the Shanghai of the rest of the world.
You know, I remember seeing Empire of the Sun, where Spielberg actually mm-hmm. filmed Shanghai. So that was a little bit before Shanghai began to recover.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of what we see there, the Bund of that is mm-hmm. the Bund that she pretty much saw in 1958.
That's right.
And the countryside, what is the relationship? When you went to this village now, what was left from that era? Anything? Or had everything pretty much been blown away and rebuilt after all of these years?
I don't think there's anything new there.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I stayed in a 17th century house. It was advertised as a 17th century villa. 17th century villa in China is not the same as a 17th century villa in Tuscany. It had a certain charm. I mean, it was wonderful to stay in this old house. You know, one of the things in China is you don't knock on the door, you just go in. And so we were just going into people's houses and talking to people and sitting out in their front courtyard. We had gone during Spring Festival. And in the next village over was a man who was known for making paper offerings. And this one family had hired him, because it was the one-year anniversary of the mother-in-law's death, something like that, to make these incredible paper offerings, this huge house, clothes, all of this out of this kind of tissue paper. And then the family invited us to go with them as they burned it at the gravesite and all of that. And so we watched him over several days as he made these things and then ended up with the family going out. Maybe the school was newish, but I don't think there were any other buildings that were less than 100 years old.
Did you get any sense of the ghosts of the past?
Always. Yeah, always you do. This goes back to that kind of lettered paper thing. People will paste on an interior wall or an exterior wall a picture or a piece of a magazine or a piece of newspaper. Some of that stuff is really, really, really old. But people leave it there. They don't tear it down. And I actually asked a scholar once, is that, you know, does that come from that reverence for lettered paper? She didn't know. But you can go in and like this little bedroom that I was staying at in the villa. They had in this room some pictures, like newspaper pictures of Hong Kong from about 100 years ago that were still pasted onto the wall. So someone, that was on one wall, and then on the other wall, on another wall, there was a kind of a cartoon strip from the Cultural Revolution. So you had, you know, the way past and kind of someone who must have maybe gone there as a vacation or had always wanted to go there, like sort of pasting up a picture of the Eiffel Tower, you know. And then on this other wall, something that was very didactic propaganda.
As I was reading Dreams of Joy and reading about what happened during the Great Leap Forward and the paroxysm that China experienced, I kept thinking that less than 10 years later, they would do it all again.
Yeah. Well, there is that strong sense that the Cultural Revolution never would have happened without the Great Leap Forward, that this was a deliberate new campaign to divert people's attention away from what had happened during the Great Leap Forward.
But the people bought it. I mean, after 10 years of being fed, obviously not literally because they weren't fed, but being fed this crap. 10 years later, they bought it again.
Yeah, they did.
When you talk to people about those years, what do they say?
And when I was in Beijing on the way out, people say, "Oh, what are you working on?" I said, "Oh, I'm working about this, you know, time period, the Great Leap Forward." They say, "Oh, yes, the 3 years of bad weather." So that's how they've learned it. It was just 3 years of bad weather. That's what's in their history books. So it's not, you know, they don't really know what happened. I get the same thing when people, you know, when I'm interviewed by journalists in China, when they read my books and I have stuff about foot binding, for example. They know foot binding was bad. They know it was, you know, a feudal thing that was bad for women. But they don't actually know what it was exactly because it's not in their history books. So, you know, one way of writing history is to not write it, just to ignore it, that it didn't happen. Can I just let me say one other thing about the Cultural Revolution is that the Cultural Revolution really started with young people. So those were people who were, you know, in, let's say, 1966, if they had been born in 1950, maybe they remember some of this, maybe they didn't. And the Cultural Revolution was something that started in the cities and sent people to the countryside. If it had been started in the countryside, it would have probably been a very different thing, because actually in the countryside, people did have more of a sense of, oh man, this is not happening again.
The Great Leap Forward ended after 3 years. The final pages of Dreams of Joy is a thriller. It's an escape thriller, and we won't say anything more about it. But the book ends, and people are still starving. How did The Great Leap Forward actually end?
They just decided to end it. I mean, that was all. It was just, okay, we're sort of done with that. And it was a kind of process of, okay, we no longer need to make steel in the backyard. We're no longer going to kill sparrows. This whole campaign of the elimination of the four evils. One problem with eliminating those birds, you know, initially they were saying they eat seed that's planted, but in fact they were better alive because they ate insects off plants. So, you know, you stop that. Then the big thing was to now let people have their own plot of land again to grow their own food. And that was the big change, was that now you didn't have to rely 100% on the commune. The commune still existed for quite a while, but you know, now you had your own plot of land that you could grow your own food. And people will take better care of things for themselves and their own family than they will for, it turns out, for the collective. So they brought in grain from other countries, rice or wheat for the north. They encouraged families who had relatives abroad to have those families send food, send money for food. You know, it wasn't just one thing. There were a lot of pieces that went into this. One of the things I think it's 1961, China all of a sudden said, a million people can leave. We're going to give permits for a million people to leave in 1 year alone. And that was kind of seen as like we're just siphoning off. Remember, China was a lot smaller then. We're siphoning off a group of people that we no longer have to feed. So there was no one big piece that changed it. It was a lot of different things.
One more question about Dreams of Joy, Lisa C. Have we seen the last of these characters now?
I think so. I think so. You know, I've been now on tour for, 6 days, and a few people have been asking, will you write a third book? But to me, and of course, I was wrong about Shanghai Girls, but to me, the end of this is so perfect. And I wanted a very happy ending. I don't think I'm known for having happy endings, but I think it has a happy ending and a very complete ending. And you don't still know everything that's going to happen to people, but they're on a good road. Let's just say that.
Let's get to Snowflower and the Secret Fan, directed by Wayne Wang. What relation did you have to that movie? Any?
They sent me every version of the script. And after every version, I would write a long letter because a lot of the time they were in China filming and I was here. Or we would talk on the phone. They didn't listen to everything I had to say, but they shouldn't have. They were making a movie, a very different art form than a book. But there is a lot that they did incorporate that were my suggestions. In fact, I've just been seeing the trailer. There's one line that was a line just in the trailer, and, you know, whatever that is, a minute, one line that I suggested and one scene that I suggested. So I know that they did incorporate a lot of what I had suggested. There is a modern part to the story.
Which was not in yours.
Which is absolutely not in the book. I think when people hear that, you know, Hugh Jackman has a cameo where he sings and dances, that he is not in that book. But that is part of the modern story. And the modern story takes place in Shanghai today. To me, this film, I think more than any film that has been made in China or has been seen here, gives a sense of that city and what it's like today. And it's such an insider's view of it. I really like some of it. And there's one scene that's filmed in one of the old bomb shelters that was built during the 50s when everyone thought, oh, the United States is going to attack China. So we'll build these huge underground, almost like underground cities underneath Shanghai. And one of them has been turned into a nightclub called Shelter. If you went there to Shanghai tomorrow, you probably would not get to Shelter. But they did for the film, and I just really am crazy about that particular scene.
What do you think of the film as a whole, if you can say?
You know, again, I think the parts that are true to the book are absolutely true to the book. They just took the dialogue exactly. There's a scene where the letter of vituperation, it takes place at a wedding where all the women have gathered, that, you know, it's a weird thing as a writer to see what you had in your head on a big screen. And because those parts of the movie have subtitles, I'm actually seeing my own actual printed words printed on the screen. It's just like a mind bender. I just have to tell you, it's really weird. But I think they did a good job. I do think people are going to like it.
Lisa C., Dreams of Joy has been out for a little bit, and certainly it's been finished for a while. Have you begun thinking about your next book?
Yeah, I was doing research in New York at the Museum of the Chinese in the Americas about 2 weeks ago, and I have already begun interviewing people. Just before I left home, I ordered a bunch of books that, you know, you can do searches on the internet for books that have been out of print for a long time. When I get home, there's going to be a nice stack of things for me to start looking at that are from this time period that I'm going to be writing about. And
can you say what time period is?
Well, I haven't completely decided, but it's going to be sort of the 30s and 40s, maybe into the 50s, maybe 1939 to 46, maybe. I don't know yet. Mostly the Bay Area, mostly San Francisco, and a little bit in New York.
And any word from Hollywood on either Shanghai Girls or Dreams of Joy?
Not yet, but Peony in Love has, they've been working on the script for a long time for that, and that's, the director for that is Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott, with all of these, you know, as my son said, but where's the part for Russell Crowe? There's no part for Russell Crowe, but, you know, they have Hugh Jackman in Snowflower and the Secret Fan, so maybe there will be.
You've been listening to an interview with Lisa C., whose latest novel is Dreams of Joy. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.